Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development for Monday, April 6th. I know that most people are here for our public hearing, but we do have one bit of business to take care of, and that should be pretty quick. So I will start by opening a work session on House Bill 2201A. Jeremy, would you refresh our memory about this bill?
Madam Chair, committee members, House Bill 2201A changes the effective date of excluding certain corporate officers' eligibility for unemployment insurance coverage to the first day of either the current calendar quarter or preceding calendar quarter. It establishes that an officer or employee of a corporation, a member or employee of a limited liability company, or partner or employee of a limited liability partnership who is responsible for fulfilling unemployment obligations for the employer is personally liable for unpaid unemployment insurance taxes in the case of a default by the employer. The bill has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued.
Thank you, Jeremy. And
well, it will have a revenue impact. We will be seeing revenues, Madam Chair. I mean, we will be seeing
the fiscal is a positive fiscal and generates income, but that's not a revenue impact.
Yes. And we did have a few questions that arose about this at the last hearing, and you have received a letter from the employment from the Employment Department after consulting with the Attorney General with their answers to those questions. So that should...
Work session?
Pardon?
We are
in a work session. So I'm looking for a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2201A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Manus Anderson moves House Bill 2201A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, Pam, Senator Telford.
Just a comment that I have major concerns with this. I think it's far-reaching. Even the IRS doesn't do this. They only do it for trust funds. I think we have concerns with corporate piercing the corporate veil. I think we have concerns of arguing who's a responsible party. As a CPA, I've had many tangles with the IRS on this, and many times I can beat the IRS on that just because of the way they define responsible party. So I have a concern there, particularly when you're talking about directing and supervising employees. Those people still may not be responsible parties. So I think it's a little... I think it's going to be challenged quite a bit. So I will be voting against the bill.
Thank you for your comment. And other discussion? Seeing none, Pam, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye. And Senator George is excused, and the motion carries. And the chair will carry this bill on the floor, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2201A.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Prezant.
Before we move to the next bill, I was just wondering if there's any hints here that I had no pencil, I had no pen.
I didn't either.
Was that because
one.
I was slow in getting down here?
Yes.
Or did Jeremy take extra pen? No, I've got them now.
I don't know. I think the record will show whatever it shows.
That's not part of the committee administrator's duty.
I'll try to be here before 5 minutes after. No, and we're not blaming Pam. This is just a Monday afternoon
correct
type of thing.
So the solution is just steal one from farther down there. I did that.
Yeah, I understand. I worked my way down there, too. Thank
okay,
you.
So moving on. I'm going to next open a public hearing on Senate Bill 894, Senate Bill 895, and Senate Bill 896. We're opening hearings on all three of these because I think most of our witnesses are going to be talking about all of them. And Jeremy, could you please briefly explain the bills?
Yes, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 894 requires that the Oregon Department of Transportation use one-half of 1% of federal funds received for on-the-job training, and it requires a biennial report. The bill has no revenue impact, and a fiscal has not been issued. Senate Bill 895 creates Construction Diversity Oversight Board and prescribes composition, powers, and duties of the board, requires Bureau of Labor and Industries to provide staff assistance to board, establishes Construction Diversity Oversight Fund, and requires that monies from the fund be continuously appropriated to carry out the purposes of the board, declares an emergency, and it's effective on passage. Again, we have no revenue impact, but there's no fiscal statement issued. Finally, Senate Bill 896 defines diversity, directs Department of Transportation to establish a contractor and workforce diversity pilot program to increase diversity among contractors, subcontractors, and workers working in connection with the department's public improvement contracts. Again, it has no revenue impact and no fiscal has been issued.
Thank you, Jeremy. And we have a lot of people who want to talk about these bills, and we have legislators with us, and we will call them first. So, Representative Mary Nolan, Representative Chip Shields, and is Representative Kale here? I don't see him at the moment, but we'll have him join you when he gets here. So please go ahead and please introduce these bills.
Thank you. I think you had a great introduction for the bills. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Nolan. I have the privilege of representing the good citizens of Southwest Portland in the Oregon House, and I come to you in that capacity and as the majority leader for the House as well. But, Madam Chair, perhaps more importantly, I come to you as a former public works director with responsibility for overseeing 400 people in blue-collar jobs and overseeing the approval and administration of tens of millions of dollars of public works contracts as well. And also as a business owner who has been actively engaged in workforce diversity throughout my business career. And I want to applaud you for hearing these bills. They represent an opportunity for Oregon businesses as well as an opportunity for Oregon workers. Everyone in Oregon shares the burden of paying for the infrastructure that we enjoy, and all of us are able to use our public spaces and our public facilities together. So I think it's very appropriate that through these bills, we should ensure that all Oregonians benefit from the jobs that will be created when we award contracts to build, rebuild, and modernize our state. Right now, that's not the case, as you know. Statistics from 2007 show that Hispanic, Asian, Native American, and non-minority women business enterprise contractors were substantially underutilized in the letting of prime contracts. And for subcontracts, African American and Asian American firms were underutilized statewide as well. Those statistics describe a gap between the talent, energy, and entrepreneurship that is available in our state and what our agencies at the state are utilizing. We have a dramatic underutilization of talent and resources, and there's never a time when we can afford to do that, but particularly in a time of economic stress. We as a state can't afford to have that talent go unutilized. ODOT has reported that their rates of apprenticeship program participation for women are at a fairly dismal 1.5%, and for minorities, just over 3%. Those numbers are substantially below the numbers of talented, qualified people available in the apprenticeship pool, and I am here to applaud your efforts in trying to move our state forward in improving our record. Coincidentally, I had an opportunity just last week to visit with Andrew Beyer, who is a vice president for Walsh Construction and also serving this year as president of the Associated General Contractors Board of Directors. His company has a very impressive track record in utilization, training, apprenticeship of minority employees, minority subcontractors, women employees, and subcontractors. And it's frankly very refreshing to me to see that Associated General Contractors would pick someone from a business with that kind of a track record to be their leader and their face in this particular time. He shared my enthusiasm and my optimism that we can, in fact, do much better And I hope that that means that we will be able to do this together, working in partnership with the contractors around the state, who will benefit not only from the work that will be let through public works contracts, but also through the development of a more stable, talented workforce. I commend these bills to your attention and hope you will pass them quickly.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I'm state representative from District 43, Inner North and Northeast Portland. Madam Chair, after years of neglect, the federal government is making a serious investment in our nation's infrastructure. And here in Oregon, we have also passed a stimulus package to help create jobs and provide some relief to our struggling construction industry. I hope we have the opportunity to make more of these infrastructure investments this session, because I believe they are an essential part of getting ourselves out of this economic downturn and laying the groundwork for future prosperity. But the challenge is that, particularly in the transportation realm and construction, I think more generally, you have, despite some advances over the last 10 years or so, you still have a workforce and construction subcontracting pool that is dominated 97% by white men. So our jobs program in this legislative session will be quite large, and 97% of it will benefit white men. At the same time, we will, in the words of Chiquita Rollins, one of my constituents in Multnomah County, be cutting what she calls the pink profession positions in our budget in the Department of Human Services, traditionally roles that women have taken more so than men. So we've got kind of an imbalance where we're increasing jobs here and decreasing them over there. And I think the same could also be said for the challenges in helping people of color realize some of these economic benefits. So I think what these three bills are all about is providing equality of opportunity, equal opportunity. And I'll let the advocates speak about these bills in greater detail, particularly Annette Talbot, who has worked very, very diligently to move these bills forward. So we've got a lot of work to do in order to help balance the scales. But I think I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge some advances that Director Garrett and the staff at ODOT have made over the last year, as well as some of their contractors. They've gone out, they've gone after creating another disparity study that has indeed suggested that African American and Asian American contractors are underrepresented. I commend them for going to the effort to do the disparity study. And then using that disparity study, they have set some hard goals on the 217 project in Washington County. And that has resulted in companies like O'Neill Electric that have a very strong reputation but have never been able to get ODOT work, to get some work from ODOT for the first time. So I want to commend ODOT because I think this is a good step. I think these bills will help push them a little bit farther down the direction that they would like to go in. And I would encourage you to pass them.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for our legislators? Okay, thank you very much for kicking things off. And next we're going to call a panel of Olivia Clark and Bruce Watts and John Jackley, and then they will be followed immediately by Fred Hansen.
No, Fred's not here.
Oh, Fred's not here. Okay, then the three of you please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Olivia Clark, representing TriMet, the Executive Director of Government Affairs. And with me this afternoon is Bruce Watts, who is TriMet's Director of Diversity and Transit Equity. We would like to very briefly share our lessons learned in providing opportunities for minority and women-owned firms and workers. And we're handing out right now a report that was done on the DBE workforce story on the Interstate MAX project. It really documents all the lessons learned and details what those methods were that we used to engage really the local DBE community. We believe that the experience is now being replicated on the Green Line, as a matter of fact, which opens up in September of this year. While TriMet's past DBE goals had been met, it was really General Manager Fred Hansen that made a further commitment to two new goals for TriMet. First, a true commitment to local DBE, the local DBE community, and secondly, focusing on building capacity for those small businesses in order to compete in the future for public works projects. Fred Hansen, who couldn't be here with us today, actually convinced Bruce Watts then to come to TriMet to implement those goals. So what I'd like to do now is just to turn this over to Bruce to share very briefly with you the lessons that we learned in our experience on Interstate MACS and continue on the Green Line. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Committee. I just want to make a couple of key points about some of the methodologies.
Oh, I'm sorry. Could you please say your name for the record?
Excuse me. My name is Bruce Watts. I'm the Senior Director for Diversity and Transit Equity at TriMet.
Thank you.
I'd like to make a couple of key points about some of the things that happened in our organization to get the results that we achieved on the Interstate MACS project and are replicating on our current Green Line projects. The first point I'd like to make is, I think, the most important. It was a commitment from the top, commitment from the organization leader. That sent the type of message which was necessary for the entire organization to understand that this was something that we were, in fact, going to do. Some of the methodologies we used, and the first thing I'd like to say is that all of the things I'm about to say are reproducible. They're not unique to TriMet. We broke the scopes of work into smaller packages to encourage DBE contractors to bid and work alongside of larger firms as the smaller firms started to build capacity. We utilized a DBE coordinator to notify DBE subcontracting firms of the project. Some of the communication tools that were utilized included holding networking and educational meetings in the community, advertising in local and minority-owned newspapers, one-on-one technical assistance with potential DBE subcontractors, and other activities to promote familiarity with bid opportunities and company representatives. We also provided technical and business assistance to DBE contractors to ensure they were able to provide the contracting work. And one other factor that we brought into it is we included workforce hiring and training standards. We had apprenticeship standards built into our contracts. Briefly, I think the technical assistance piece is something I want to hit just for a short minute. We discovered in the process of building Interstate MACS that a number of small minority contractors weren't even certified by the state of Oregon. We provided assistance and brought the certification office to a number of meetings that we held throughout the community. And we discovered that a lot of the contractors didn't have systems in place because they were smaller contractors. They had worked on private work and really weren't familiar with public work. One of the examples is that when we started to provide technical assistance, one of the contractors brought their receipts in a shoebox. That's how small they were. We found that by providing the technical assistance ongoing through the life of the project, it allowed those contractors to grow in a systematic way. Another thing we did is we teamed smaller contractors to come together to be able to work on larger scopes. A classic example of that is the Northeast Urban Trucking Coalition, where there were a number of small truckers who couldn't provide trucking services individually, formed a team, and provided $2.8 million worth of trucking services to the project. So it allowed a number of small contractors to come together. These methodologies, as I said, worked extremely well in the Interstate MACS, which the story you have in front of you illustrates, and we have replicated those on our current Green Line and will continue to do so. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is John Jackley. I'm the Communications and Business Equity Director for the Portland Development Commission. We, too, have had some lessons learned, some of them quite hard, that we'd like to share with you today, as well as some of the things we've been able to do over the last couple of years. When our executive director took over almost 3 years ago, if there was one universal consensus about the Portland Development Commission, it was that it needed some changes. And one of the top areas to change was how it connected with the community and what kind of diversity results it was able to produce. Over the last 3 years, PDC's made a concerted effort to change its internal culture, to change how we connect with the community itself, and then to change our policies and practices. And as a result, I'm just going to summarize a couple of these. We've increased MWESB spending in terms of total dollars by more than 300% over the last 2 years, from $16 million to $42 million. MWESB spending is today about 37% of all of our contract expenditures. In addition to PDC dollars, we also leveraged an additional $42 million last year out of the South Waterfront project. So if you look, if you count South Waterfront, the total MWESB utilization we've been able to get has exceeded $80 million in the last 2 years. Within these numbers, minority contractors were the single largest group, followed by women contractors, with emerging small businesses third. On the workforce side, minority and female workers represented 28% of all the hours worked on PDC projects. And on South Waterfront, for those who earned their journey card, which is a construction industry version of a four-year college degree, 22% of those who earned their journey card were people of color. And then finally, and I think this has a direct connection with a lot of our successes, our apprenticeship hours represented 23% of all hours worked, and we have a hard contract requirement of 20% apprenticeship hours. We got a lot of help along the way. It wasn't just PDC. We have an extremely supportive City Council, Board of Commissioners committed to diversity and social equity. As with TriMet, our Executive Director, Bruce Warner, has led this from the top. We've also had a lot of assistance from organized labor and the contracting community. Companies such as Hoffman Construction, Walsh, Howard S. Wright, they've proven beyond a doubt that the contracting community can embrace diversity and still profit economically. Our ability to work well with organized labor has been an added advantage. Over 95% of our projects and dollars pay prevailing wage. So we've been able to achieve these kinds of workforce and contracting successes on projects that almost all, except for the smallest of our projects, prevail. We've done a lot of internal culture changing, too. Our key executives take cultural competency training. Our external policy consultant, Mr. Harold Williams, was the state's first affirmative action director for the state of Oregon. We now have technical assistance agreements with each of the four minority chambers of commerce for outreach, identification of firms that we can help nurture and support. All of these relationships are ongoing, and we expect them to continue. And then finally, the third area where we made a lot of changes was in four significant policy advances. We established a business and workforce equity policy for the agency. It used to have a goal of 20% of the PDC investment in a project. Today, it's 20% of the hard construction costs. We also require that apprenticeship hours be 20% of the total, and we also have aggressive goals, but we do assess liquidated damages against contractors who don't meet our apprenticeship goals or who don't follow our policies and procedures. On South Waterfront, we have an active oversight committee made up of contractors, organized labor, PDC, and the developer, and we sit down every month and go over every active project by trade, and we look at the diversity participation. We see if it's meeting the goal. If it's not, we work with the contractors and the first and second tier subs to get those goals there. Thirdly, we have an intergovernmental agreement with the City of Portland to provide monthly MWESB and workforce updates. So we don't wait till the end of the fiscal year and go, oops, we missed the mark here. We look at this every month, and then if it looks like we're falling short on a project, project or one area, we move quickly to try and fix it. And then finally, on a broader, more thematic level, our Board of Commissioners earlier this year changed their strategic plan to include social equity as one of the agency's foundational values. And I know it's just a plan, but it does kind of set the tone and the approach for the whole agency. And then finally, we believe that even with this economic downturn, even though the dollar amount of our construction portfolio can change from year to year, we believe that the social equity policies will ensure that for whatever construction volume we do have, we'll have diversity participation on the workforce level, on the contracting level, and even though dollars might go up and down, we want to make sure that the disadvantaged communities aren't adversely affected by an economic downturn. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony, all three of you. And is Linda Andrews here?
No, she's with PDC, but she couldn't make it.
She's not here. And John Molis?
Commissioner Molis from PDC is out of the country.
Okay, that's a very good excuse for not being here. And then next we're going to call Joan Plank, Michael Cobb, and Robin Freeman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Joan Plank with the Oregon Department of Transportation, and with me is Michael Cobb, our civil rights manager. Did you want us, Michael and I were signed up to testify on 894 and 895, and Mr. Lauer from our major projects unit was going to testify on Senate Bill 896.
If would you'd like to join me, that would be
up?
Fine. Sure.
Okay, Michael's going to handle the testimony on 894.
Good afternoon. The name is Michael Cobb, manager, Office of Civil Rights, Oregon Department of Transportation. One of the things that I hear going through testimony so far is the common thread, and that is looking at ways to diversify and increase opportunities for both workforce development as well as small business contracting. And to just start off by saying that, that ODOT's mission is definitely in the same vein. Relative to Senate Bill 894, which is speaking of the utilizing 0.5% of federal funds that the department receives to channel 0.5% of that funding into training and other programs like that. We've been along that mission for some time now. Currently, the last time we took a look at our numbers and where we were heading, at the end of this biennium, we will have spent approximately $500,000. Under the new funding, under the new bill, that 0.5% would equal about $5.5 million. And we're not 100% sure yet if we could indeed spend all of that amount. But under the current guidelines that we have, you see, the programs that we developed to spend this funding have to be in concert with the federal highway guidelines for programs and implementation and so forth. So looking at that looking at that amount of money that the new 0.5% would generate, we could very easily do about $1.65 million. Now, of course, we're looking at ways and exploring opportunities to widen and get more expenditures out of the programs that we could and would be developing. We can continue to work on the programs that we have existing today and look for other opportunities. And we just need to consider that if we do divert money, that much money, into the 0.5%, that we would have to consider other ways of balancing out program expenditures for highway construction projects. We have a number of programs going for skills development, job readiness, mentoring and retention, outreach to women through a contract that we have with Oregon Trades Women. We're doing some work with Portland Community College. We recently signed or getting into signing another IGA with the Salem-Keizer School District, and we actually launched into Polk County because they heard about the program that we were doing there for the high schools. I probably should back up a little bit, realizing the shortage of workers that we have today. What ODOT has decided to do is to look to the future and to get into the high schools. Even if we found the magic solution to the dwindling workforce today, we need to replenish that. So we've reached out into the high schools and with them developed curriculums that will give these kids an opportunity to also graduate with a certificate in construction. We've given them OSHA training. They actually did some bridge framing in one of the courses that they took, and it was so successful in Salem-Keizer that Polk County reached out to us, and we're developing a program for them also. Apprenticeship hours, as you know, are race and gender neutral, but however, we do encourage contractors to focus on the hiring of women and minorities. We do put a push there and strongly encourage them to look in that area. And ODOT reached a goal in 2008 of 10.2% apprenticeship hours, and we achieved a five-year average of 9.5%. So the transfer of federal funds from highway construction projects, in summary, would support our commitment to achieving increased opportunities and diversity for workforce and small businesses, and we would just have to consider how we would balance out our other programs. Any questions on that particular bill?
Yes, Senator Monacan.
Thank you. I don't know who brought the bill forward. It did come out of the Committee on Commerce and Workforce, but I'm wondering why they chose to take ODOT money, 0.5% of the federal funds that go to ODOT. We're having such problems with transportation, getting enough.
Yes, I'm sorry, but I do not know.
Okay.
Yes, Representative. I'm sorry, Senator.
I think we'll probably get an answer to that from another panel.
Okay.
Okay, let's keep going.
Okay.
895, Michael.
Relative to 895, again, here the bill calls for the implementation of a construction diversity oversight board, and that particular board would be made up of representatives from the construction community, Bureau of Labor and Industries, various state agencies, and including ODOT. And the purpose of the board would be to increase the number of contracts awarded to women and minority-owned firms and the number of women and minority apprentices in the construction industry. And again, ODOT has been working quite a bit in that area already. We do have a workforce development program, which was aimed at increasing the number of apprentices that are available in the workforce. We also implemented what was called a small business initiative, where we met with, we convened a committee that met for over a year in meeting with small businesses and looking at what are the issues and what are the roadblocks there for opportunities for small businesses getting more contracts. And through that, we've developed a number of programs to help to train these firms and bring them up. We had that disparity study that we commissioned back in 2007, and you heard that mentioned earlier, that the result of that showed that we had underutilization in African American and Asian communities, and we thereby we got a waiver from DOT back in Washington to implement goals, and we did do that on 217 for starters, and we're looking at other ways. But you need to realize that in order for the state of Oregon to really, really benefit here is that we cannot hang everything on simply the disparity study, because that disparity study, we only have 3 years. That waiver expires in 3 years. So during that time, what are we doing with the small firms in Oregon to train them should those goals go away? So what we need to look at here is to bring the state, the small business community in this state, to a place where we are not relying on having hard goals in order to create opportunity for the small businesses. So therefore, what we've done was we've created a number of training programs and opportunities. We issued a contract called a capacity analysis, study and information, and contracting opportunities contract. And that contract is to look at what are the capacities of the small businesses in Oregon. We're having three meetings on the subject
Legacy Emanuel Hospital, Clackamas Community College in Hillsborough, April 23rd, 24th, to meet with the areas and talk about what are some of the issues and what are the capacities of these small firms so we can identify their training needs. We've also contracted with the small business development centers throughout the state, where we offered scholarships to small businesses to sign up, where the small business development centers are teaching them on the basics, the elements of contracting and how to run a small business. We have a training session going on tomorrow, as a matter of fact, up in the Flanders building from 9 a.m. to noon. And there we will have subject matter such as bonding and insurance being discussed, what a short-term lending program could mean, and so forth. So we're looking at opportunities here to give information and knowledge to these small businesses to help them to develop. So, I'm saying all this to say that we are working along these lines, and the only part of this bill I guess we had questions about was the funding and where the funding would come from. It did mention that a fund would be established, but where would it come from and how would it be maintained?
Okay, thank you for your testimony. And
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Prezansky.
I just want to follow up on what Mr. Cobb said, because that's a point I'm going to have. I'm not sure who's going to be speaking as to the different components of the bill, as to who has put it together, since this was also another one that was sponsored by the committee itself. But specifically, whoever is going to be coming forward, Section 4 on page 3 talks about this oversight fund, and I think there are some questions as to where is the money coming from, how are we going to maintain it, and is it money that could be used in some other ways or not?
I think we got our witnesses slightly out of order here. We're going to have two panelists coming up that will be able to answer all those questions.
Okay.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Thomas Lauer. I'm the from ODOT's Major Projects Manager. We're here this afternoon to present our testimony related to Senate Bill 896. To begin with, I'd like to reaffirm that ODOT is committed to the use of women and minority firms and to developing a diverse workforce on our projects. But in doing so, we are also required to comply with applicable state and federal requirements as we move through our contracting and procurement to move our federal highway, to move our highway projects to bid. Most of our projects are largely funded through federal highway dollars, and as a part of that, as we go to seek alternative contracting, and I'm here to speak to Section 5 specifically of Senate Bill 896. As we move to alternative contracting, we are required both to comply with all the parts of Oregon procurement law, but also we have to comply with the requirements of federal highways procurement process. And to move to a move away from a low bid contracting process, we need to seek an exemption approved by our director. In doing that, we are required to have so findings that it is in the public interest, that does not incur favoritism, does not diminish competition, but also, and most particularly, must result in substantial cost savings in the project, and has a need for specialized expertise on the project. This is contained within ORS 279C-335. Additionally, we must also petition to the Federal Highway Office, locally at the district office, to ask for an exemption from the low bid from them and have concurrence before we move forward. And they also specify that we must find technical merit within the project that would justify allowing us to move to an alternative process. We have done this, and we have done this successfully. In the last three calendar years, we've moved an average of 98 construction contracts per year through the low bid method. And at the same time, we've averaged about three contracts using the alternative process. And that's where we can clear the hurdles of finding substantial savings and technical merit that would justify it. When we do that, we do include requirements that would allow for scoring criteria based on diversity or diversity history as a portion of the technical requirements that are allowed. However, it must show stand regard against the other technical requirements that are required by the contractor to be successful in those procurements. In addition, on those similar contracts, as we are now allowed, after having completed a disparity study with the Ninth District Court and having been given a waiver by Federal Highways, we're able to include hard goals in those projects in addition. So this allows us to place hard goals and also score our contractors merit based on his history of diversity and his diversity proposal for the project. The difficulty within the Section 5 of the bill is that it would require a large number of projects going to alternative contracts on the basis of diversity. And unfortunately, diversity has not stood under 279C335 as a criteria, nor has it been a standalone criteria from Federal Highway. In specific reference, in part of my duties, I administer the OTIA 3 bridge program, and we've moved a number of very large projects to bid, and particularly we've targeted two along the Columbia River Gorge, the Sandy River Bridge, and another project that's just secretly known as Bundle 209. And we moved them both forward on an alternative contract basis and look to include diversity requirements within it. And we found that we were able to move successfully on Sandy River, which is an extremely complex structure that we're engaging to build, valued at around $70 million. And we were successful in acquiring the required waivers for both the state and from the federal so that we can move forward on an alternative contract. But just down the road to the east, we come across Bundle 209, which is a group of rather similar, if I would call them ordinary highway bridges. And the project doesn't have a great deal of technical merit. We granted a great deal of resistance from our Federal Highway Office in saying that it didn't have the merit, did not meet the muster of tests to go past that hurdle, and so we had to back off of that. We were able to include a hard target goal for minority participation, and this project will bid in May of this year, but we were not able to go to the alternative contract method. We are, in other ways, as Mr. Cobb referred to, have the small workforce development and small business initiative programs that are working quite well. And I can report to you that for the Go Oregon program, ODOT has let nearly 100 contracts. And of those, 35 went to small and minority firms. In addition, in the last year, we have worked very aggressively on the apprenticeship side of the program, particularly within the OTIA 3 bridge program, to meeting the 10% apprenticeship goal as we required. And we had experienced a history of generally making a target, but we've had intermittent success on specific projects. We've gone to a very aggressive disincentives process where we put substantial and financial incentives and disincentives for a contractor not making a 10% goal. What we only at this point have five contractors working within that, but within those projects we're currently achieving almost 25%. I don't know that will continue through the life of the project, but it's looking very promising as well. We have goals on other projects as well for the apprenticeship program, but they are achieving somewhere around 10.2, as Mr. Cobb had said.
If you could please summarize your testimony.
And in summary, we generally support the premise of the bill to study and to look at what other contracting entities in the state of Oregon has done, and we have gone to school on their techniques. But meeting the requirements of Section 5 would be very difficult for the agency.
Thank you. Okay, are there any questions for this panel, Senator Montesanderson?
When you say Section 5, you mean Section 5 of Senate Bill?
Yes, Section 1, Article 5. I'm sorry. Article D, I'm sorry. Yes, let me, Chairman, Senator. I misquoted. It's Section 1, Section 1D, be specific.
And which, I think we were trying to clarify which bill that was.
That would be a bill 896.
896?
Okay. So, Madam Chair,
yes.
It's Section 1,
D.
3D.
That's page 2, lines 1.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
So let's try to get back in the order that we had intended to be, and I think next we'll call Randall Edwards and Joe Desano.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, former State Treasurer of Oregon, and also the co-chair of the Oregon League of Minority Voters. I'm here with Joe Desano, the other co-chair of our organization, and on behalf of our organization, we're here to support all three bills. The League was created a little over a year ago to promote a broader understanding of the issues that uniquely impact minority and communities of color in Oregon. We are a multiracial group that champions equal opportunity on issues in Oregon, and we strongly believe in education, dialogue, and public policies that lead to solutions for more inclusion. I want to compliment you on holding these hearings today on these three bills. They bring light to issues that need our attention and set out a way to improve job opportunities for all Oregonians. That is why we support these three bills. So why do we need this legislation? Well, we know historically that there are higher rates of unemployment, poverty, and lower earnings in minority communities. For example, 4 years ago, the Latino community represented 31% of the impoverished in Washington County. And in Multnomah County, we saw an unemployment rate for African Americans nearing 20%. With the total unemployment in the state currently over 10%, one can only imagine how this economic crisis is affecting minority families. We also know that Oregon's population, like the nation's, will get more diverse over the next several decades, so the workforce will look different. This means we have an opportunity and a need to be more inclusive in training all segments of our economy so that we have opportunities in the state. The bills before you focus on construction work, which is an important source of living wage jobs and contracting opportunities in Oregon. While the sector certainly has slowed down recently, the stimulus money that is targeted to it has not. This is why there's a great need for a short-term as well as a long-term plan to put this money to work in Oregon. Training people for jobs takes time and planning. Senate Bill 894 targets training dollars to support construction workforce development for women and minority workers. And the construction workforce is also demographically aging, so there's going to be greater opportunities to help replacing those workers as well. That is why we need to devote more resources to recruit and train women minorities now to be prepared for the future. As I said, however, we have a crisis brewing today. We would like to see a short-term plan that prioritizes a portion of Oregon's as well as the federal stimulus money towards helping women and minority-owned businesses and the workforce. We must make sure that these interests are not forgotten in the need to get this economy going. I would suggest you look at amending Senate Bill 894 to make this a requirement as part of the Oregon Way Advisory Group process, which, as you know, is overseeing and advising the governor on placing more federal stimulus money in Oregon. Your leadership is needed. One in every $3 spent on prevailing wage construction projects last year were state projects. The state needs to clearly express its expectations to those businesses it hires to build these projects, and that they will make opportunities for women and minorities, and to be accountable for that diversity in apprenticeship as well for the hours prevailed for the project. A diversity oversight board contained in Senate Bill 895 is critically important to the long-term strategic action plan for achieving better diversity results in public contracting and public works in Oregon. It will use community-based organizations to implement the support and training for women and minorities to be successful in the field of construction. It will require all recipients of state funds to report publicly on their diversity contracting and workforce outcomes and to be held accountable for those results. I would also suggest we need people of color at the table to help formulate this plan, along with state agency representatives who oversee and can influence state-funded construction projects. This is how TriMet and the Portland Development Commission made their plan a reality. In close, equity is extremely important for Oregon, and it should be a core public policy expressed and planned as part of our state law. Business and unions who work in this sector should not be expected to do this without the leadership from the state. That's why we need to pass these bills, and I support them wholeheartedly. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Good afternoon. My name is Shota Zono, co-chair of the Oregon League of Minority Voters, and I'm honored to be here with the citizen Edwards testifying on this bill's behalf. As you have heard from other testimonies before us, I think it is so important in this economic times that we really consider the issue of equity. And Rand and I penned an opinion piece at Oregonian really talking about the importance of public policy as we look at towards the spending of the stimulus money, whether it be the federal money, state money, or city money. I think there's an opportunity for us to be held accountable, as the governor's office has said. It's online. Follow the money. Follow the number of job creation. If there are disparity in unemployment figures today, whether it be in people of color or in women, and we should be following that money to make sure that every job created does follow that pattern. If the goal is to create 4,000 jobs, percentage of that should be those who are unemployed. This is not about stimulus money for those who are, have jobs. It's really about creating new jobs for those who don't have jobs. If the people of color minority population are 25% unemployment, for example, in certain part of the state, 25% of the stimulus money should go towards creating those jobs for that community. You have significant opportunity in this time to really make an impact on what your commitment is as state legislatures and the governor's office, and as for the support oversight, because it is about leadership. You heard from PDC, you heard from TriMet, Fred Hansen, Bruce Warner. Leadership at the very top is so important in order to make impact on especially those communities in most need. And I urge all of you as state legislature to make sure that you are doing what's best for all of us in the state of Oregon. We all love the state. We have one opportunity to make your money count and follow the money. Make sure you create the jobs where the jobs are most needed in all parts of the state of Oregon, for all parts of our community, and all for all of our citizens. So I really want to thank you for holding the hearing. I think it's so important that you lead the way, the Oregon way. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you both. Great.
Thank you.
And next we will call Annette Talbot and Connie Ashbrook. And did you have somebody else you wanted to bring up with you? Okay, great. Good afternoon and welcome. Thanks for waiting so patiently.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. Thank you so much for holding the public hearing on these bills. My name is Connie Ashbrook, and I'm Executive Director of Oregon Tradeswomen Incorporated. And today, Oregon Tradeswomen urges you to support passage of this package of legislation to make sure the state adopts a diversity plan in place for the construction projects it funds. It's time for the state to take strategic steps to improve equity in contracting opportunities, workforce, and apprenticeship, as other public agencies have done. The data that we do have suggests that there are major disparities in how many women and people of color access contracting and workforce opportunities. And some of that information is summarized in the fact sheet in your packet as Attachment A. As I said, I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Tradeswomen Incorporated, and today I have some of our students and graduates here with me, and many of them are unemployed right now and looking for work, and we know that the stimulus will help them get back to work. Oregon Tradeswomen is a nonprofit organization that educates girls and women about careers in the construction, energy, manufacturing, and utility trades. We provide pre-apprenticeship training to women interested in entering the trades, and last year we graduated 92 women from our training program and could have trained many more if the resources were there. Their average starting wage was $12.50 an hour, and they were on a career track for training through apprenticeship, which would increase to $18 to $32 an hour within 3 to 5 years. It's important to remember that the major way for diversity in construction is to get more diversity in the pipeline through pre-apprenticeship training and through programs in the schools. So apprenticeship is the major pathway to this type of career. You've heard from PDC, from TriMet, that with leadership, community involvement and development of a diversity program with performance accountability and transparency measures and solid planning, that outcomes can be improved dramatically. And we want to thank them for their efforts because they show the way for others that follow after them. This is happening in other places around the country. In fact, there's some information in the packet from the Port of Seattle. The cities of Seattle, King County, and Sound Transit developed some very, very innovative programs to improve the percentage of hours worked by apprentices, and they were able to achieve 17% apprenticeship hours, people of color working 33% of those apprentice hours, and women working 12% of those hours. And that compares with the one Oregon state agency that reports reaching 10% of the project hours worked by apprentices for 1 year, with only 1.5% of the hours worked by women and 3.16% worked by people of color. And you'll see by the folks here in this room that there's many, many more women and people of color that are very interested in these jobs and would be available to work for those jobs if they were open to them. Today, you will see many organizations that are here in support of this legislation. It represents a very proactive step which focuses on the future and avoids dwelling on the past and what was done. These groups have seen what strategic planning can do and what the programs adopted by other public agencies can help ensure that women and people of color can successfully participate in the construction field. There is a window of opportunity right now, and because of the stimulus money, that we need your help and leadership to make sure that there is equity in the shovel-ready projects and that there's planning so that there is a that we do see more project hours for current and new apprentices ready to work and gain their on-the-job experiences. We know that the committee will put its own stamp on the bills and develop amendments to achieve the best public policy result. But know that you have community groups, minority contractors, labor and workforce training advocates in favor of the concept of these bills. We urge the Senate to take the lead in getting the state on track to adopt a strategic equity success plan. Oregon Tradeswoman believes that this planning approach represents the Oregon way. The Oregon way of planning together with the public and private sectors in open meetings and responding with a unified plan. Thank you so much for your consideration of these important bills.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, members. My name is Annette Talbot. I'm vice chair of the Oregon Tradeswomen Board, and I thank you very much today for taking the opportunity and your time to hear these bills. I would like to go through the bills since I am one of the individuals who worked on actually drafting them, and to let you know that they are really a work in progress for you to take a look at. In the past, we have unfortunately spent a lot of time complaining about one particular agency that actually does have a plan and their results instead of focusing on the fact we don't actually have a full plan for all state agencies in diversity and construction. So today we're hoping to actually focus forward and look what we can do better when you look at TriMet and PDC and what they were able to accomplish with the plan. So the bills are offered in that spirit of having an opportunity to actually look at a proactive approach instead of just complaining about something that hasn't been done in the past. The board, as Connie said, is our attempt to look at a unified state strategic plan. Right now, ODOT is the only agency that really has a plan for workforce diversity in regards to construction and an apprenticeship program. And as Representative Shields says, they have made great strides in many respects, and we really appreciate all the work that they've done. But the university system, the community college, and DAS, and others in state government get a lot of money for capital construction Commission as well. And there aren't any plans for those projects. And what we would like to see is offered by Senate Bill 895 is that the state actually look holistically at what it does with construction. In 2007, they spent approximately $1.8 billion in 1 year in construction. So that's a lot of money where you could design some strategies and learn from best practices. And as former Treasurer Edwards said, it is important that it's not left to the contractors and labor to try and create all these best strategies. The state and the leadership of this committee and the Senate and the House can actually help create those strategies by creating this board and letting a lot of people who've had the opportunity to make things work, like PDC and TriMet, to actually offer their insights in the process. This 15-member board, again, is proposed for your consideration in terms of its composition. Perhaps you would see that there are other people who belong on it or some that don't. But we do feel that it is important that community-based organizations be a large part of the board, because they are the ones where you've talked to PDC and TriMet, you've heard from them. The community-based organizations were the ones who really helped them actually make the outcomes real, not just a process in place, but actually achieving outcomes. So those community-based groups, groups that support minority contractors, groups that support tradespeople, groups that run pre-apprentices programs, they're really key to making whatever plan is put together successful. The state agency folks on the board would also be important because they need to be bought in and understand why the strategies are there and how they can be helpful. And then, of course, we want to make sure that labor and contractors are represented on the board as well, and you'll see that in the initial draft of the bill. We really believe the other piece that hasn't happened is that transparency and accountability. People do want to know how the money is spent that's being spent on diversity, and we want to know that it actually achieves outcomes. Connie spoke to how the Oregon tradeswomen can give you actual figures about who they recruited and what they got in terms of wages when they were placed in a job. That's the kind of data I think that we should have when we're investing public dollars, so that you can show that there's results, not just a process. So that's the purpose of the board. There are many states that are starting down this road. You have some attached to my testimony. The governor of Michigan has created a program. It's already off and running and been very successful initially. Missouri and Wisconsin have programs and boards that they've done for their diversity in recognition that across the country a large number of construction workers will be retiring, so this is the opportunity to plan. Many apprenticeship programs take 3 to 5 years for someone to graduate, so if you don't start now with recruiting and getting them into the program, you have that 3 to 5 year window that you have to really account for in terms of public policy. But one thing you will also notice that King County in Washington has also achieved really significant results in their ability to recruit apprentices, and that is also attached to your testimony, and you can see that the numbers that they have, so it's something that can be replicated. They've got an apprenticeship rate of close to 17%, and with over 12% women and 32% minorities. Interestingly enough, one of their recommendations in that study still is, though, to dedicate more public funding to expand apprenticeship training. So they have seen that that is the pathway to progress for people, is to make sure women who go into the trades don't necessarily have a father or a brother or an uncle who have been in the trades to help them navigate that process. And so having that a pre-apprenticeship training and having strength training, which our program provides, is really critical to making them a success. So the board was put together as a starting point for your discussion. One of the things that came to light after putting the board together last fall was that the Oregon University system may well be someone who needs to be part of the board because of the large dollars infusion that the state legislature gave them, as well as what they may be receiving under the stimulus package. And maybe someone who actually works in construction from the schools itself, as opposed to someone from the chancellor's office. And perhaps the attorney general could be helpful. Obviously, ODOT has suggested that there are some contracting rules and federal and state funding requirements that might be something that they have to make sure that they adhere to. And so that kind of advice to the board would be very helpful. And finally, former Treasurer Randall Edwards noted that they would like to see, as the Oregon League of Minority Voters, perhaps an effective date that be moved up so that the Oregon Way process with stimulus money and grants that they're seeking actually incorporate some equity success ideas as well. So I would stop in terms of the questions if you have for that board, or go on to the next bills if you'd like.
Any questions about that bill?
This is eight.
We've been talking about Senate bill
895.
Right, 895. Go ahead, Senator Presents.
Annette, if you can give us a little understanding on the Section 4, I understand this is to establish a fund, but it doesn't really say what the fund's going to be used for. I understand from looking at it, looking for allocations from the feds, other funds that may come in for apprenticeship program. So is this fund, what is the, the use of the money that would come in? Is it to operate the board, or is it to actually use to actually get training going? Tell us, you know, how this is going to work and what's the opportunities of monies and maybe some of these other states that already have these in place. What has been their success in actually getting funds coming in?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Prezansky. The concept of the board and the would be to actually have grants awarded. ODOT does do some funding now, and Oregon Tradeswomen have been the beneficiary of some of that funding and have gotten lots of women jobs with that. And we think those grants have been well spent in terms of getting people in the pipeline. So we would love to be able to see more grants like that. And look for the state to look at some of the new opportunities in green jobs, which are many of which are construction and trades related, and ask for grants to help us look at planning for getting women and minorities into those new green jobs, which are growing at a rapid rate. So, you know, building wind turbine sites and things like that, energy efficiency opportunities. So we could look to fund some of the board's grants activities by getting other grants from the federal government. In addition, the one-half of 1% bill, the concept on 894 was that some of that money from ODOT could be used, as long as it was related to highway trades, for training and grants. As I said, they do give out some of that money now. What we would hope is that we could do a better expenditure of those dollars so they get more bang for the buck. And also to be, again, more transparent about who gets the money and what kind of results that they have. So it would be a variety of different funds, hopefully, that would funnel into that. I would expect that running the board, other than Bowley actually having to staff the board, would not incur a lot of expenses, so we weren't anticipating that the fund would actually have to carry that. And I think you will be receiving some testimony from Bowley later. I believe that their staff person was unable to come, but they do have some prepared testimony in support of the bills.
And we do actually have written testimony from Bowley that's been handed out. So I
think that the idea was just a variety of different funds to be deposited in there and then spent as strategically as possible based on the findings of the board, based on them looking at other states. I believe in Michigan and Missouri and Wisconsin, they have been using highway dollars for their grants and their programs. And so they've focused, obviously, on highway trades, I'm sure, to be consistent with federal spending requirements. But there's a great deal of work that will be coming up through the stimulus package on roads and bridges as well. So we would welcome that kind of, you know, additional expenditure to help with diversity. If I might, just because it came up before, the one half of 1%, It's difficult to know, and I was talking to Joan Plank from MoDOT about what does that mean in terms of the dollar figure. So I have heard everything from 1.6 to 5 million. So I'm not sure if we know exactly what that looks like in terms of the amount. But what we do know is that, according to a foundation that works on transportation equity issues, and it's a faith-based organization, they have said that every $1 billion spent on highways creates almost 48,000 jobs. If just 15% of those jobs were given to women and minorities, that would be 7,000 construction jobs. So we have the opportunity to spend the dollars. We do need to be careful and cognizant of the federal regulations so that we are not creating problems for ODOT. But I do think that that ability to provide that collaborative, planned approach, we know from studies for women who work in non-traditional jobs, that where there are those collaborations between labor management and community-based organizations, that there are 25% more likely women to hold those jobs and retain them. So that intervention of being able to actually provide those services, supportive services, retention services, mentoring, is critical to the success of the program. I worked a lot in healthcare workforce, and you know the senator has too, and I sort of liken it to the effort there of trying to get men in as nurses, because there are some gender separations in the way that you look at certain workforces, and women in construction are similar to that. You really need to target them and to plan and provide particular projects and programs for them. Did that answer your question?
To start, thank you.
Okay. Yes. Senator Monis Anderson.
And why did you choose federal funds coming to ODOT?
Thank you for asking that. The bill as drafted, unfortunately, did not reference the federal fund statute, but the federal fund statute that one half of 1% is targeted to is actually for diversity and non-discrimination. So the feds allow you, as I understand it, in the U.S. code, to have a state spend up to one half of 1% on that sort of non-discrimination and diversity. So that's where that came from. And other states have actually gone there and taken what's a federal discretionary standard and made it a state mandatory standard, so there's significant funds available. Obviously, the committee can change what that percentage is, but that's the model that other states have used. Maine has taken it and made it a requirement as opposed to a discretion as the federal law allows.
Okay. I think you had probably more testimony, but I wanted to ask you something just as a general question. So in these very rough economic times, I want to ask you whether this is the right time to take an approach like this, because I think I can hear people saying, well, there aren't enough jobs now, and if we start trying to parse these jobs out, won't that make things even harder, or harder in business or whatever? So I want to hear what your response is to that.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll take a crack at it and then let Connie. I think one of the key things that we're talking about here that's unique about these bills is there's three populations we're looking at. One is minority contractors and women contractors. So getting the opportunity that bids are being put out there and making sure that those contractors have access and opportunity to actually get those bids. The other is the workforce. And as you well know, coming from the trades and your background, the only way you get into that workforce is through an apprenticeship program. So the workforce piece, obviously the people who are already journal-level women, they're going to get jobs if they're available. What tradeswomen is most focused on, and I think the bill strategically looks to, is the pipeline of the apprentices. We're not taking away jobs of people who are currently working. We're training people for the future to replace the people who will retire. A great deal of employment data about occupations and projections is based on both growth and retirement. So even if you don't see a lot of growth in the construction industry in the next year or two, although with stimulus you may, but you will see the retirements. And so you're replacing people who retire. So we're not replacing people who are currently working. We're looking to the future to make sure that when those people do retire, that there are women and minorities ready to step into those jobs. And
That's this chart in the packet.
Okay. Briefly, on the best value contracting pilot program, I think one of the things that did not come out, that's Senate Bill 896, that did not come out very strongly in the TriMet and PDC testimony was that they do use this type of a process. So they don't focus on a low bid process. They do a negotiated process. And if Mr. Jackley or the TriMet people are still here, I hope that they could provide you with more detail about that. But I do think that's one of the keys to their success is that they're able to negotiate not just on price, because price is still very significant issue, obviously, with public funds, but they also look to the history of the contractor and their success in working with people of color and women, both in the contracting opportunities for subcontractors and in the workforce and apprentice. So they're looking at, as I believe the gentleman from ODOT said, they actually do some scoring criteria on how those contractors have done in the past. So you're rewarding contractors who have actually achieved the public policy that you're looking for, which is more diversity. And I'm sure Mr. Jackley would be more than willing to discuss that. I also had the opportunity with Representative Shields to meet with some contractors last fall and discuss the low bid process. And they did say, this was very helpful for me to appreciate, was that they did say that the low bid process is very difficult for them to account for diversity when they do, because they get a bid in, they need to focus on the low bid in order to be successful, so they don't have a business case as easily to make for diversity as they do for the price. So they're not really able to consider some of that. So I would ask the committee to note that contractors are in business to make money, and unless the public policy helps them see that diversity is also part of the practice you'd like them to engage in, they need to make a living, and that's what they do. So I think the previous speakers mentioned about leadership and being forthright about making sure that the state is delivering that leadership. Then contractors and labor who are trying to meet those goals have that, and they understand that the state is behind that, and that's part of the goal. I would liken it to being the same as an on-time construction goal, a safety goal, and diversity should be right up there and accounted for. As Mr. Jackley said, in the South Waterfront, they meet monthly. They don't wait till the end of the project to figure out they haven't met the diversity goals. They work on it and problem solve along the way, and that's the approach that we think that these bills can provide. And I know there are lots of people behind me who want to testify, so I don't want to take up a lot of more time unless okay. There's other questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions? Okay, thank you both for your testimony. I think at this point we're just going to keep going through the list in the order that people signed up. As I said before, we do have written testimony from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I don't think Steve Sims is in the room. He couldn't make it today. So how about Harold Williams? And I think we have Harold Williams and Harold Williams too. Harold Williams Sr. and Harold Williams too. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Harold C. Williams Sr. I'm owner of CH2A and Associates. I have a nonprofit called the Diversity Institute that I'm involved in. I'm vice chair of the board of Portland Community College. You want to?
Oh, well, my name is Harold Cleophas Williams, too, also with CH2A and Associates in the Diversity Institute.
One of the things that we want to point out is that it can be done. The Department of Transportation is a great organization, but it needs a transformation. And let me talk about transportation from a historical point of view. On the marble out in front of the Capitol, there's a statue. And there's a gentleman named York that led the Lewis and Clark expedition. That was transportation, clearing the pathway. We have a historical perspective with transportation. And we talk about minorities and women as though they are abstract. That is, should be a misnomer that we should remove. They are vital parts of our society. An example, if we drop an atomic missile anywhere in this city, will it just stop with African Americans, the majority community? It's everybody. What we're saying if we look at the opportunities that Oregon has, and this is the greatest state in the nation. I've been here 50 years. I don't want to live anyplace else.
I second that.
But what I'm saying is that we have to approach it differently. The test market in industry for cars, for fashion, they use Oregon. Because if you can make it in Oregon, you can make it anywhere. Diversity. We have the small number of population. We can relate. You. We come and talk to you. In New York, that's not the case. The average person don't get this kind of action. So what we're saying, let's use it in a positive way that we can be inclusive of everybody. The dollars that we have here, don't put it in that you're doing something special for minorities and women. It is a part of the fabric. When you have in a carpet, you have different colors, different threads. You move one of those threads out, it affects the carpet as a whole. That's all we're saying. People are sitting back, well, we can't do this, we can't find. Well, we were the consultants for the Portland Development Commission. They had a bad reputation. In 2 years, we went, and Mr. Tibbetts, I think, is the poster, Tibbetts, did the study and found out when they started in the minority community, the approval rating was 30-some percent. 2 years later, with our efforts working, it's over 80%. And what we found is the thing is, if you let people know that they have an investment in the vision of economic opportunities, we can achieve and move in a positive direction. I am sick and tired of people saying we can't because we have to lower standards and we have to find this little ratio because women can't fit into this box. Well, when the military, when we had the First World War, the Second World War in particular, who was on the front line and ran the factories? It was women. If we look at all across the board, when we're cutting the railroads and doing the labor, Washington, D.C. in construction, there were people that looked like me that built it. They didn't go to an architectural school, but they had the talent and skill sets. We're saying now that the state of Oregon has an opportunity. I'm on the board of directors of Portland Community College. You just blessed us, this state, with a bond levy of $370-some million for new construction. Opportunities will be abound that will be inclusive of everyone involved. What we're saying is that we can do things positively in this state if people stop making excuses. I don't have an indictment against the Department of Transportation or any other state agency, but I'm saying we can do it because the talent is all over the place. All three of my children, I have three beautiful children, a daughter and two sons. They all graduated from Jefferson High School. They all have college degrees. They all advanced in their professions. They came from a school where people say it can't happen, but they did it. And we said it can be done in this field of in transportation with diversity. What is diversity? It's as simple as this. You make a pot pie, I make a pot pie, but you season it different than me. But it's still good pot pie.
That's it.
And all we're saying is let's change the flavor of the pot pie. You know, you don't have to discard somebody else. But hey, you like chocolate cake? I like coconut cake. But do I want coconut cake every day?
No.
Do you want chocolate cake every day?
No.
I don't think so.
No.
So we have to look at it from that standpoint. Not that you're doing something special for somebody else, but you're bringing them into the framework of everyday living. You have children. Little Susie wants things a little different way. Tommy wants it a different way. You love them both, but you accommodate each one's interests. It is the same thing. The difficulties of life you can handle with ease. The impossible takes a little bit longer. We choose to deal with the impossible. Methods change, but principles stay the same. The basic principle of business is to make a profit. The basic principle of humanity is the respect of one another. All we're saying is bring everybody to the table. Don't use this as an excuse, because this economic fallout, folks who never thought they would be affected
Boy.
Are in the unemployment line. They have qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
What we're saying, we've sold this bill of goods that everybody needs a four-year degree. And you know if they get a two-year certification as a mechanic, they have a job tomorrow. And in many areas, in wiring, in steel and fabric, carpentry, all of these areas come into play. This is the greatest state in the country. We can change race relations quicker than anybody else because we're small in population. We can change the fabric of economic development tomorrow. If you hire every African American in the state tomorrow, you haven't just spent, you've given up this much and you still got all this in your pocket. You give up this much and you got all this. What are people fearing for? Women, the lady just mentioned, you're not taking the jobs from anybody. It's preparing for the future.
Exactly.
Anybody in the trades will tell you. We have every three that's in being retired, you have one coming up to replace them. We're going to have a shortfall, no matter what race,
man,
of skilled labor in this state in the next 10 years. It's going to be massive. So are we going to play around in the race and gender game? Are we going to be open to making sure this state stays great and great that it is? This, we talk about the City of Roses, this God's country, which this is. Oregon is phenomenal. I respect you and I honor you for the fact that you're bringing these bills to the forefront. Put some money in it, and I'll tell you this. Give me an opportunity to work with you and whoever else you choose. We can turn it around in less than a year, improve it. We did for PDC. We can help you do it. The issue is, are you willing to look at the best of you and not complain about what you think could be the worst? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
Well, I guess that's all been said. Any questions?
Kind of hard to follow that, isn't
it? No, I've learned.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you both very much for your testimony. Next, we'll call Penny Painter. Is Penny here? And Yolanda Cindy, please come forward.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. First thing I want to do is tell you how honored I am here to be here today before you.
Did you say your name already? I'm sorry.
No, my name is Penny Painter.
Go ahead, Penny.
I work for Cooper's Eats Engineers, and my title, well, a couple of them, is a workforce representative and also program coordinator when it comes to programs. I'll go ahead and let you introduce yourself if you want.
Sure. My name is Yolanda Cindy. I'm a board chair of Organizing People, Activating Leaders. I also own a consulting company called Yolanda Cindy Consulting, where I do management consulting and training for nonprofits. I also am the executive director of the Association of Environmental Health Academic Programs, where I work to diversify and increase the environmental health science workforce. So I'm here wearing three hats and concerned about workforce issues.
I'm also the vice chair of the Oregon Native American Chamber, I guess I should include as well. And I'm here today as, well, first of all, an example. And I kind of sit on the fence because I have a serious passion for the trades and have had for many, many, many years as I'm a single mom, and if it were not for the trades, my three daughters wouldn't be living at the standard that they are today. I'm a carpenter by trade. I started out as a carpenter. And, I moved up the ranks because my job and, well, you get older in life and you kind of got to move along. And so I, want to bring to your attention, without telling you my whole life story, that there is no cap in construction as far as the trades are concerned. And these programs that are in this bill, 894, regarding the pre-apprenticeship program training, the support, the mentoring, and the retention services are important for everyone. And I've been working now for quite a few years to bring to the forefront that they are extraordinarily important for women and people of color. As, I tell you, I worked in the trades for 18 years before I ever knew about apprenticeship. literally. And I taught myself, and it took me twice as much time to teach myself a trade as it did if I would have went through an apprenticeship program or had that kind of assistance. I'm here today also to talk about the successful things, because I, too, am working on a contract with ODOT, and am very grateful for it. I work on a mentoring contract to go out and train contractors and their lead workers to mentor the incoming workforce and to set up mentor-mentee pairs with individuals working out in the field, so it's easier for them to learn and better for them to learn and safer for them to learn. I recently, a couple years ago, ended a contract that I worked on with ODOT called the Native American Work Initiative. And the Native American Work Initiative was put into place by ODOT to increase the number of Native Americans working out there on bridge and highway contracts in the apprenticeship trades. And we started out counting how many people, Native American people, applied to the apprenticeship trades. Well, according to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, that number is not countable because everyone doesn't report people who apply. People are not counted until they're indentured by the state of Oregon, and that means they go out to work through an apprenticeship program. And so we decided to start counting the people that were indentured, and we're working primarily with Native American people. Well, I can proudly here say today that we increased the number of Native Americans working in the trades out there 155%. Sounds great, doesn't it? And I'm very proud of that. And I had a lot of help doing it from the workforce development folks out there in the tribes. I worked with them. On the other hand, there were only 73 Native Americans working as apprentices in the whole state of Oregon when I first started. And that number to me is astounding as compared to 17,834 Caucasian men. Males. That doesn't count women or other minority folks. So, yes, we were very proud of it. And in doing so, we also were able to work with the tribal workforce representatives and train them, do a train-the-trainer class through ODOT to train them to bring people into the apprenticeship programs in the state of Oregon.
I need to ask you to summarize your testimony because we still do have a lot of people and we're going to run out of time.
Okay. Well, I absolutely applaud the efforts that ODOT has made. And I also applaud the folks here that are here today to promote their programs and to promote training. And I know that you're going to hear a lot of the same information as far as what I'm saying here today. I just wanted to bring those numbers before you. And I also want you to know that I'm also working with the folks that have the IGA, agreements with ODOT to provide resources to folks that are coming into the trades. So there are some things out there that are in place as far as the resources to assist people that get through these programs that are coming into the trades. And the programs are absolutely necessary. I think that they really do assist people in general to be successful in the trades if they're more ready when they apply.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and committee members. A lot of what I wanted to say has been said, so I'm going to be brief. I'm in support of the Senate Bill 894, 895, and 896. And I just wanted to say, historically left to their own devices, we all know that employers have not always been fair or have treated workers fairly. We have employment laws today not just because employers decide they wanted to be nice to workers, but because workers fought for those rights, like the 8-hour workday. We have child labor laws, equal employment laws, because people fought for them. And to name a few of those protections. So in a state with the demographics of Oregon, I just feel that it's imperative that we have laws to promote diversity, because we can't depend on employers to do that for us all the time. These bills, in my opinion, are a good start, and they're critical to giving everyone a fair chance at apprenticeship opportunities, employment opportunities, and contracts. So I strongly urge you to support these bills. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you.
And next, we're going to call Bob Shipwreck and Marcus Mundy and James Posey. And I think a couple of you have signed up on more than one of the bills, so please come forward. We're going to try to get everybody in, so. Yes, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Shipwreck, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. I've got some questions today and some thoughts and then just a couple statements, I believe, with the committee, and I'm going to be very brief in no particular order, but Senate Bill 894. The reason this caught my eye, and I have not had a chance to talk to, I guess, Annette and folks, because I really didn't know who put this bill in, but to us, on-the-job training is a trainee program at ODOT that is not apprenticeship, and that's what we call it, the on-the-job training. Now, it doesn't say apprenticeship in the bill. I suspect that that's what the proponents meant, but I did want to point that out because the trainee program, frankly, doesn't lead to anything. You're just on the job for so many hours, and typically you're released. So, in fact, we've tried to get rid of that.
Head's nodding when you said apprenticeship, so I think that's
thank you. I assume that. The second question I have, and I can talk to the folks later on, but it's relating to using the funds for on-the-job training. In apprenticeship, you have related training, which you go to school for, you know, read codes and things like that, and then the on-the-job training is actually physical work on a job site. So I don't know what the money would be expended on job on the job training unless it was wages and fringe benefits, which I don't know what that would accomplish, frankly. I don't know what the intent was here. So I just wanted to leave you those questions. The other thing, I did speak to some of my folks this afternoon. I'll just leave this with the committee because it was mentioned that right now we need jobs, not training. We got a lot of people that are in apprenticeship programs right now, but they're out of work. So if indeed the fiscal on this is $5 million, we would encourage that money be spent on highway construction. Also want to address one other issue that keeps coming up, and that's this aging workforce. I met with the state demographer. I didn't know we had one. We do at Portland State University. Construction is the second youngest career or area of employment in the state. Actually, a lot of young people have come into the building trades over the years, and we're actually quite young in compared to other professions. We also have, unfortunately, hundreds of apprentices out of work at this time. Just thought I'd leave that with you. And I'm losing my voice. Senate Bill 895 is the Construction Diversity Oversight Board. I like this a lot. I think that this is something that we should have done a long time ago. Even though it's very formalized, I would hope that it's responsive enough to really get some ideas out there and get some things done. You can get data from BOLI and the various public contracting agencies about employment levels and things like that, apprenticeship. I should mention as well, I have commissioned a study through the Labor Education Resource Center at the University of Oregon on apprenticeship in the trades, the building, both union and non-union. And I just wanted the committee to know and the public that the initial results based on BOLI data shows in the union apprenticeship programs, we're at 16% minority and 7% women. So I should have a breakout by craft perhaps as early as the end of this week, which I'll share with you. Senate Bill 896 is the ODOT Contractor and Workforce Diversity Pilot. I just want to, I'll just share this with the committee that I've been working on apprenticeship at ODOT now since the legislature passed the OTIA 3 project, four or five years ago. They actually started a pilot project to try and get more people in apprenticeship, and frankly, Madam Chair, it was a big failure. I'm not sure they recruited a person. So my only question here is,
I agree with the intent here, but perhaps there's a better way to get it done. And I haven't had a chance to really think through all this, but perhaps contracting it out or doing some other method, I don't know, but in the interest of time, I'll just leave it at that. In closing, I just want to say one thing, that we know these programs work. TriMet and the City of Portland are perfect examples, but there's one thing, one telling thing that John Jackley said that's missing in some of these programs that don't work really well. And this is kind of where I'm at after all the years that I've worked on this. When are we just going to start enforcing the laws and the rules and the goals that we set up in these contracts? We allow contractors to skate on them. There's nothing happens. Hey, have a nice day. Yeah, you said you were going to hit 8%, but you didn't. I mean, we've had major contracts with no minority contracting goals in them. What the hell's going on here in North Portland, of all places? So I'm very sympathetic to the folks that are sitting behind me. I think we ought to put damages at the end of a contract. If the goals and rules haven't been followed, the contractor signed a contract to do it and perform it. If they don't do it, they should pay a penalty. That's how I think you deal with this, because it's been going on for years, and as long as you allow people to skate on the rules, it's going to continue. That's just me talking now. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Please go ahead.
All right. Good afternoon. My name is Marcus C. Mundy, and I'm the president and CEO of the Urban League of Portland. Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and other members of the committee, for letting me speak today. I'll be as brief as I can. The Urban League is a direct service and civil rights organization that has worked for the social and economic empowerment of African Americans and others for the last 64 years. It says 65, but we're 64 years old in Greater Portland and Oregon. The Urban League has worked to expand workforce development opportunities for African Americans and others for all of these years, and currently provides a heating, ventilation, and air conditioning job training program in partnership with PCC in the City of Portland, as an example, among our several workforce programs and partnerships. Unemployment among African Americans in Oregon is unacceptably high, in my opinion, it borders on the criminal. Today, the United States is in the grips of the worst financial crisis since the Depression of the 30s, and in fact, if our almost double-digit Oregon unemployment figures are to be considered a crisis, and we believe they are, then African Americans in Oregon have been living in crisis mode for years. The Urban League is poised to publish its treatise on the condition of African Americans, the state of Black Oregon, for the first time in 17 years, and it's only been delayed this long. It was about ready in December when the whole economic spectrum in the U.S. fell out, so we've been updating it for current conditions. It documents the status of African Americans across key economic and social indicators, including employment. Chair Rosenbaum, earlier you asked why these programs or any of these programs were necessary. Why don't, in this stressful economic times, it's because of these unemployment conditions. The official unemployment rates show that African American males are twice as likely to be unemployed as their male counterparts overall. The decennial census shows that African American male and female unemployment rates have been at their current level, roughly 15 and 10% respectively, since the late 1970s. Well known to this legislative body is the fact that African American contractors have faced barriers gaining access to government contracts because of a number of reasons documented in the Regional Consortium Disparity Study conducted on behalf of 10 government agencies during the mid-1990s. The Urban League welcomes the direction of Senate Bills 894, 95, and 96. We hope and suspect that they have grown out of a recognition that, and not just ODOT, but that ODOT and other state agencies could do better in achieving equity and diversity in their contracting practices as they relate to opportunities for people of color and women. ODOT has had diversity measures in the past. The results, however, have been mixed, largely because the agencies controlling the funds did not sufficiently change their management culture and project management practices to ensure effective minority participation. Increased minority involvement was not among the key hard measures designed to gauge the success of their projects, and we submit that without metrics to identify success, short shrift will be given to those outcomes. There's a host of other problems about prime contractors and qualified subcontractors, which is in the body of this text, which I will skim over. I would encourage you to read it and your staffs, but the creation of a construction diversity oversight board should avoid past pitfalls by continually monitoring progress on how successfully state agencies have implemented their diversity goals, and to regularly review the annual spend of the agency and the percentages that are being procured by minority and women businesses. We feel, in addition, that it is important to monitor specific individual goals for minorities without the customary aggregation of these goals with women and emerging businesses. I think this particular rider is necessary because, in recalling earlier testimony, there are even fewer minorities with brothers and uncles and husbands in the trades than even women in the trade. So it's important that we capture it for each subgroup so we can know for each subgroup what is going on. While we particularly welcome SB 896, our community has emphatically told us to convey that it will take more than good intentions to successfully implement workforce diversity. There must also be goodwill among those who have done things in a particular way for a very long time and who may be resistant to change. And in Mr. Shipwreck's testimony, he mentioned if we enforce the laws that are on the books, we can go a fur piece as far as making sure that we get these things done. So while I submit, finally, that 0.5% may seem like a lofty goal from where we are today, I believe that our goal for state-controlled contracts should proportionally reflect the variety and the demographic of Oregon. So 0.5%, in my mind, is inadequate, but it is a good start. So we have at the Urban League examples on how these systems can work and would be willing to provide our expertise as far as helping people parcel out these contracts to the different subcontractors. Whether the workforce is reflective of the growing diversity of this state should be a benchmark in gauging whether this project is deemed to be a success. Thank you for your attention and thank you for letting me testify today.
Thank you for your comments. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is James Posey. I'm the former president of NAMCO, National Association of Minority Contractors. I'm currently the president of the Coalition of Black Men in Oregon. And just about everything I wanted to say has been said. I just want to pass out to the committee person here a letter that we forward to the director of the U.S. Department of Transportation relative to the continuing problem in Oregon relative to this issue of African-American and other minority contractors. Today I came with a list, and let me just say I never thought I would be agreeing with Bob Shipwreck. It's a big one.
It is a big one.
Because as an association was not consulted, we were not participant in putting together these bills. I don't know the reason why, but really we would have told folk that I don't care how many bills you put forward, whatever you do, if you don't enforce the existing laws, if you don't feel that those issues relative to how you got where you are have been resolved, any new legislation will be in the shadow of the fact that you don't have the will to achieve what you're trying to go at. For example, Title VI, which is very explicit about racial discrimination, really applies to this issue of race versus gender, and it talks specifically about race. I'm not sure ODOT can tell you where their Title VI report. They're required to have a Title VI report, and you all probably have not seen that Title VI report, and if you have, then maybe you could make some suggestions based upon the Title VI report. Another issue very clearly and distinct is the fact that you have so much fraud and abuse in these existing programs. People who get contracts purporting to be disadvantaged and in fact are not. That issue is not addressed anywhere in any of this. So if you move forward on these bills and you are talking about trying to have real effect and real results, you'll need to have that sort of compliance out on the ground, making sure the programs are going and the resources are going to the people intended and are qualified to get them. No teeth in compliance. I'll tell you this today as I sit in today.
if you all decide that you're going to withhold any contract for a contractor who does not comply with the letter of making sure people from various communities are involved in these contracts, it will spread like wildfire over this industry, and you will get not immediate results. It would be forthwith results by basically holding up the money. Same thing with ODOT. Don't let ODOT dazzle you with all these programs across the board, these programs here. We're not looking for programs. They're not getting paid for programs. They should be getting paid for results. And if they don't have any results, then somebody needs to move on to another area. That's how it happens on my job. When I don't perform, I got to go. Same way with ODOT. When they come in here with a program and tell you that they're going to do this and done that, and they've been doing it for 2 years with no results, somebody's got to go. That's how it happens with me. Here's the other real piece I want to talk about, is a comprehensive involvement and evaluation. Maybe this oversight piece will do it, but I'm going to tell you, we've had those pieces to go, before. They've been at lower levels in ODOT and sometimes higher levels in ODOT. Evaluations alone don't mean nothing. The only thing that's really going to count is, again, whether or not you have achievable results, and there are consequences for not achieving those results. Let me say that one more time. If you have achievable results and there are consequences for not achieving those results, then you will have some action on the part of what you do and what you say. Let me just say to you all right now, so you understand that the world is changing, and it's even more difficult for minorities and women to stay in the industry and work in the industry. Because, let me just explain this to you. Clearly, for these years they've been absent and been in a disadvantaged status, they've been less competitive for the future. So when you have your mindset about it's moving forward, you have to understand that the folk who have been behind and been discriminated against and disadvantaged for 15 years, they're not going to be able to start at the same place the existing people start. So you need to keep that in mind. Now, here's a point where...
And James, I don't want to cut you off, but we still do have...
I will wrap this up real quickly. To that point, even though TriMed and PDC are doing a good job, they really have challenges that they haven't even seen yet. They are working on a backlog. They're working on past performance. The future still requires... They don't have anybody in compliance to speak of in either one of those organizations. And I've been on them about it for some time. Until they get some compliance in their programs, their future is in question. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you all for your testimony. And finally, we'll call Melissa Unger, Tony Jones, and Deborah Williams. And I think that completes the people that we have signed up to testify. Thank you for waiting so patiently.
Thank you for having us.
And actually, you can just go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I'll make my testimony rather quick, but I'm Melissa Unger, and I represent SEAU Local 503. And we've actually gotten involved in a variety of contracting conversations this session regarding just the way that we contract in the state. And a piece of this is because, as somebody who represents public employees, it's a reality now that public services are provided by public employees and private contractors. And kind of to what the last people up here said, is that we need to make sure that we're holding them to the same standards of responsibility and to the same results. And so just a couple of notes is that we believe that one thing is a lack of transparency in our contracting system continues to cause some of the problems that have been identified. We think that we need to open the transparency about the bidding process, but also about who gets bids so that we can better analyze the overall contracting system. So we are working in the House on a couple of bills regarding that. We support these bills because we believe that, you know, when you
require results, you get results. And when you, if we want a certain set of results, then we need to be asking for them. And I think that there's a variety of people who are asking for them. And so that's why we're here today. And thank you very much for your opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony.
Hi, I'm Deborah Williams. I'm the Evening Trades Pre-Apprentice Program for PCC, and I came as a representative also of the pre-apprentice programs, and which has been in force for 10 years, and I am supporting these bills because I'm from the front end of it and looking at the workforce, the diversity workforce, and we serve women and men and the low-income communities, and mostly North and Northeast Portland. And we've been successful in doing so. But without some of these bills being in place, we have been really struggling in trying to keep them engaged, keep them in the workforce and growing in the workforce. And for highway construction, that is really an area that is limited to people of color and women. And currently we have entered into, or we're about to enter into that contract with ODOT as a pilot to really try to put some of these individuals to work. But when I say on the front end, because the construction industry is one of the most forgiving industries that we have had and that we still have, where someone can make a mistake and be able to come back and build a career. That's why it's so important to do pre-apprentice programs as we do and trying to help these individuals be competitive in this market. And most of our individuals, yes, is people that have made mistakes. But we have been really, really fortunate in the 10 years to be able to build this pool of work-ready individuals. And I brought two of those individuals with me today, a woman and a man, and both who came through our program had no clue of what the industry was all about. And we did the pre-apprentice program, and currently they're both union carpenters and got jobs soon after they graduated, like a week after they graduated, each one of them. And now they're on the out of work list, but yet still they're paying their dues and really waiting to get back into the workforce. So we really, again, support these bills, and we do know what the outcomes could be.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Tony Jones. I'm the Executive Director of Metropolitan Contractors Improvement Partnership. We're a nonprofit organization founded by NAMCO and other industry professionals such as Stacey and Whitbeck Construction, Hoffman Construction, TriMet, Legacy Health Systems, and the Portland Development Commission. And the goal of the organization is to provide business capacity development services for minority construction businesses. And our focus is on developing their construction and business management capacity. And our goal is to work with industry partners to ensure that minority businesses will secure work on public and private projects and to build the capacity of business so that they can complete larger projects and more complex projects. Currently, MCIP focuses on minority-owned businesses in the Portland metropolitan area. MCIP supports the increasing diversity in public construction bills for the following reasons. Some of them have been touched on, but I want to touch on briefly. The disparity study from 2007 demonstrates an underutilization of African-American contractors and Asian-American subcontractors, and that there are not enough DBE primes to even perform a meaningful analysis. So meaning that what this is demonstrating is that they're not utilized at all. So we need to increase the availability and capacity of these businesses. In Multnomah County, based on 2000 census data, and I know that others have stated this, that the Multnomah County's African-American population in poverty is more than double of the county's white population. But we also have discussed that the skilled building and construction trades offer people of color unparalleled opportunity to support themselves and their families with living wages and create real economic wealth. I just want to add a few quick comments with regard to a couple of these bills and James's comment about monitoring and enforcement is really key. We really need to make sure that it happens, but resources need to be available to make sure that it happens. So with regard to the strategic planning by the Diversity Oversight Board, I want to encourage you strongly to make sure that there's appropriate resources as you have that board so they can do their work effectively, to do the monitoring, to do the reporting, to do the analysis, and to make sure you have accurate information of what's happening. Putting together a board with no resources is once again, a tool with no teeth. The best value contracting pilot program, this is absolutely essential. This shouldn't be a pilot program. It should be a way of doing business. As PDC and TriMet has attested to, by utilizing a contractor selection process, which gives contractors the opportunity to be selected based on price and past performance, quality, as well as their plan to actually achieve diversity, is absolutely critical. And every project I've worked on that had success has used and negotiated what's called construction manager general contracting process. The third bill, with regard to training dollars to support construction workforce development, is also crucial. The comments about not only preparing the future pipeline, but making sure that the current pipeline has the support, have the resources they need to develop, is critical. If you look across the country at other successful programs, having those dollars, continued dollars there or increased dollars there, is absolutely critical to having successful minority women in the workforce. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, and I think that we are out of time. Is there anyone I missed in the audience? I think we got everybody. Okay, thank you all for your excellent testimony, and I will close the public hearing on Senate Bills 894, 895, and 896. And members, we still do have a quorum, so I'm going to ask unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow Senator George to vote on House Bill 2201A. Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And Senator George, how do you vote?
Madam Chair, I vote no and serve notice of a possible minority report.
Okay, Senator George votes no and serves notice of a possible minority report on House Bill 2201A. And I'll close the work session on that bill. And with nothing further to come before us, I did want to mention one more thing, that we have a very full hearing on Wednesday, so we're going to start right on time, and we are trying to extend our time at the other end to make sure that we're able to accommodate people. We've got some people traveling from out of town for the hearing, so stay tuned, and okay, we'll get word to you as soon as we know. And we are adjourned.